embarrassing when she failed to show up for her job at a fast food restaurant Monday morning. Lou Perini told the Kenosha News that the girl was at his gas station at 52nd Street and Sheridan Road late Sunday night. He says she bought gas, paying for it inside with a credit card, then left northbound on Sheridan. Investigators, while describing the case as a homicide, have not revealed the cause of death. Mackey would have been a senior this fall at Indian Trail. White House Chief of Staff Reince Priebus may have little left of his job, but his title, the Kenosha native's fortunes, have long been a source of speculation given his limited role, colorful band of rivals, and the president's public slights. Those questions escalated this week with the arrival of Trump's new communications director, who was hired over Priebus's objections and has made clear that he reports directly to the president. The already tense relationship took a darker turn when the newcomer suggested in a late-night tweet that Priebus was one of the leakers Trump has railed against. Trump has privately floated names of potential chief of staff replacement, but has said he's not planning more staff shakeups anytime soon. In sports, Kyle Schwarber homered twice and drove in four runs, and the rolling Chicago Cubs beat the Chicago White Sox 6-3 last night for their third straight victory. And we can tell you that the Brewers lost yesterday, unfortunately. If you're a Brewers fan, I don't have the score right in front of me, though, but take my word for it. The WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service, mostly sunny skies today, a high near 77. Clear tonight, a low around 60. Tomorrow, sunny, high near 76. For Sunday, sunshine continuing, warmer still, a high near 80. Right now, 70. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is coming up.
And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. And we are going to begin today's morning show with Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College, paying sort of a surprise and unannounced visit to the morning show, and you can probably imagine why. As all of you surely know by now, southeastern Wisconsin is rocked with extraordinary news that indeed Foxconn is coming to the area. As far as I know, we still don't know exactly where, but this enormous facility is going to be built somewhere within the WGTD listening area and somewhere within the Gateway Technical College District. And President Brian Albrecht is, in a sense, right at the ground floor of this extraordinary project. In fact, he was on hand at the Milwaukee Art Museum yesterday for the agreement signings between the state of Wisconsin and Foxconn. We'll get his impressions of what that event was like, and then even more importantly, talk about the potential role that Gateway might play in this gigantic project that stretches before all of us. President Albrecht, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. Good morning, Greg.
Thank you for making time for this impromptu conversation.
Well, it's my pleasure. You know, like you said, every time you talk about this item, I get a little goosebumps here because this is so unique and so special, and I think so very different for all of us to even try to conceptualize the magnitude of the project and the enthusiasm all the way from the President of the United States, the Speaker of the House, and, of course, Governor Walker. And it is really going to, I think, be a transformational change for the way we think about the future that we not only work in, but that we live in.
Right. And right here, Dave Cole, our general manager, was telling me the other, actually, this was probably more than a week ago when some of this was still a bit up in the air, but he was saying this is going to be the biggest story in southeastern Wisconsin since the closing of the car plant. I mean, particularly on an economic front, no single event has been this big, and maybe in the history of the state, there's never been a single event as potentially transformative as this.
Yeah, and that's what I'm hearing as well. Our largest single capital foreign investment in the history of Wisconsin, and potentially the largest in the history of the United States. So this is a major commitment by Foxconn to not only invest in the United States, but invest right here in southeast Wisconsin. And I think it certainly poses some challenges, but what an opportunity. I mean, it's so unique and so special. It will not only help drive the way we think about the jobs in our area, but I think it will begin to build a lot of bridges between our communities, whether they're local here in Racine and Kenosha or way beyond into Chicago, Milwaukee markets. And, you know, it has an impact that ripples throughout the entire nation.
Mm. Tell us a little bit about what yesterday's event was like at the Milwaukee Art Museum. We were there. Those of us who are watching the feed over WGTD saw you actually front and center in the frame as part of the audience there.
Yeah, well, I've been very fortunate to be involved in a lot of the conversations around Foxconn and what it might mean for our region. And, you know, when I arrived yesterday for the big celebration, of course, the first station I saw was Dave Cole and WGTD, so I was really proud of that. And thank you for your coverage of all of these great stories. But it was not only ceremonial, but I think it was really uplifting because this discussion around Foxconn has really brought a new level of optimism for our state, for our nation, and certainly for our region. So a lot of great dignitaries, all of our legislators, elected officials were there, local elected officials, state elected officials, and business leaders, and they were all coming together to talk about what this could potentially mean for the economic prosperity of the companies that they represent and of the region, and how this can hopefully transform the way we've positioned Wisconsin as a leader in innovation and technology.
Mm. I thought one of the most interesting remarks made by the gentleman from Foxconn, I have his name here someplace.
Terry Goh,
that's right, was his description of the United States and the Middle East, and the Midwest as part of it. His description of the coasts are the wings, but the Midwest is the muscle, right?
Right.
At the heart of the bird. And that's a really interesting way to think about the Midwest, a part of the country that often is overlooked by those more glamorous coasts.
Right, and I don't think I will ever forget that. I mean, I had not thought of that. I knew the project was called the Flying Eagle, but I had never thought of the contextual framework that, you know, on the West Coast, much of the activity is around innovation and technology, Silicon Valley, and in some ways it can become a little disconnected from the individual person. And on the East Coast, he commented that that's very transactional. That's where a lot of the financial districts are in New York, New Jersey, and so on. And while they operate in both and they need both, they're a technology-driven company based on an economic framework of financial transactions. His message was that the heart of the country was really built around the Midwest and the manufacturing principles and work ethics of the individuals here. And he really felt that being a part of that family, and he used that term often, was important to him. In order to let the wings of the eagle soar, you needed to have that work ethic and that commitment to the job that needs to be done. And I think it sends a really strong message to not only Wisconsin, but the entire Midwest region on the values that are established here and our heritage and our history and how we now can become a part of what I'm calling the new economy. And that's an economy driven by technology, innovation, and the way that we really want to maintain our economic viability as a world leader.
We're speaking with Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College, in kind of a surprise conversation reacting to the events yesterday with the signing of agreements between the state of Wisconsin and Foxconn, and talking about the potential impact that this development is very likely to have right here in southeastern Wisconsin. President Albrecht, I really am curious to know, I think a lot of people are curious to know, what kind of conversations have occurred between Gateway Technical College and any of the powers that be discussing this possibility. I suspect there's a limit to what you can tell us, but I hope you can at least give us a general sense of how many and what kind of conversations have occurred and between whom and what kind of things have been talked about.
Sure. It's getting a little easier to talk about it because in the beginning, of course, there's an awful lot of confidentiality, and there still is. So, you know, there are many decisions that need to be made, and you wouldn't want to derail any of those great dialogues that are going on. A lot of relationships are being built. But a little over 2 months ago, we did have the opportunity to host a delegation from Taiwan at our S.C. Johnson IMED Center and began the discussion around what technology applications we already had and in place and training programs like engineering and IT and mechatronics and systems automation and computer numerical control.
And can I just ask, did you know at the time what that was about? I mean, before they arrived, did you even then have a sense of what this visit was about?
We had a pretty good idea. We didn't know exactly what the anticipated magnitude of the project was, but we knew it was called Flying Eagle, and we knew that there were folks looking at some investments in our region. And we do this quite often, actually. We work closely with Racine County Economic Development Corporation and Kenosha Business Alliance, CABA. And as new companies move to our area, Gateway is invited to those meetings to think and talk about what services we already provide. More importantly, what do we have to look forward to in the future? You might recall 2 months ago we were working with Haribo. They announced they were moving to our region, so that was an important dialogue to think about mechatronics. Ironically, Foxconn is also the same industry platform around mechatronics, and so we're working to ramp up our programs. But to get back to that visit, I mean, that really helped set the stage for me thinking about how important it was that we really start to look at the cooperative agreements that we have with our university partners, with our K-12 partners, and building a talent pipeline for thousands of people, not hundreds, but thousands. And while we were accustomed over the years to be able to adapt to economic changes and bringing in hundreds of students, we're not quite familiar with bringing in thousands. So we're working very diligently to ramp up our services and make sure that we're ready when Foxconn is ready.
Right. I have to say, this is going to be kind of a strange thing to admit, but as I've been watching different things on television, some of the faces I've seen on the screen regarding the training of all these workers have been the faces of someone from MATC or from Herzing or from Marquette. And I keep thinking about, well, what about Gateway? Because obviously that's the school I care about the most and know about the most of these kind of schools we're talking about. Does this shape up to be kind of a competitive situation in terms of Gateway versus MATC versus other potential schools who could play a really important role in this? And how is that likely to shape out?
Yeah, I don't think it's I wouldn't use the word competitive. I think there's a tremendous amount of opportunity for everyone to benefit. I mean, the region, this whole effort being coined now as Wiscon Valley is much more than any single community could possibly manage. You're talking about, you know, 10,000 plus employees in the factory, but then you're also looking at another 20 to 30,000 employees that are going to be needed to support all the supply chain companies and all of the, you know, the new services that are going to be required. So I think there's opportunity for all of us. And in the current structure of our educational systems, I mean, you'd have to double the size of any single campus in order to even begin to compare to this. So it's better to leverage the resources of a Waukesha County Tech, a Milwaukee Area Tech, or Blackhawk. And we've all met already, all the presidents, and we are we're working very diligently to find out how we can leverage the faculty that we have and the technology and equipment that's in our labs already and see if we can't find ways to streamline the process, shorten programs. In fact, we'll be meeting with the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee to take a look at some new engineering opportunities that could be brought to our district down here. So, you know, while we hear different quotes and comments from other educational institutions, I don't see that as a negative. I think it's very important to recognize that education and training is key to these new jobs. So these are not the kind of jobs that maybe you might have gotten 40 years ago right off the streets. These are technology-driven, computer-literate employees with an advanced interest in innovation and technology, because what they build today is not what they're going to build 5 years from now. So we've got to be able to be thinking about lifelong learning, and it's going to take a lot of our efforts to help educate our entire citizenry on what the future is.
And so you're already seeing a spirit of cooperation between these various schools, you're all going to be in this together in a sense.
Yeah, and you know, in the Wisconsin Technical College system, I mean, that's been one of our cornerstone anchors here in that we collaborate between colleges. Currently, we share programs with METC, and we do an awful lot of work with Waukesha County Tech because we're in the Milwaukee 7 region together. And so we do a lot of have a lot of dialogue around economic development and business development. I think this particular interest by Foxconn changes the dynamics a little bit, again, because of the magnitude, but also because of the massive amounts of interest that we're going to need from local suppliers. So you're talking 7,000 contract workers in order to build a facility. Then you have to maintain the facility. Then you have all the infrastructure that goes around supporting it, housing developments. And there's so many elements that are that surround the idea of a Foxconn campus that the whole region's going to benefit.
Right, absolutely. And of course, on the one hand, I'm watching, for instance, a newscast from Milwaukee, and it only makes sense that they would pick up the phone and call MATC or Marquette. But in fact, this is going to happen, it looks like, right here. I mean, so in a sense, this will be on the home turf of Gateway Technical College. But beyond that, of course, this speaks exactly to some of the most exciting innovations that Gateway has already developed. I mean, this is right on the bullseye in terms of what this school has stood for now for the,
for
the last 2 years.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've actually shared that in the meetings last night in Milwaukee. They asked if we're prepared. I said, we've been preparing for over 100 years, right? We were prepared in 1911 when there was a major economic shift in this region, and we put programs together to support a transition to the automotive industry and developing mechatronics and automation as we moved through the 80s and 90s. And here we are today in 2017 looking at a highly integrated technological system where IT is integrated with manufacturing, and we call it smart technology. We're probably all familiar with the things that we like on our phones where you can control your temperature at home with an app, and that's the interoperability. Those are the driverless cars. That's how things work today. And many people call it the Internet of Things. And so we, while we have programs that are positioned for that, this really sets our eyes on the future. And I saw yesterday in Milwaukee what some of the future might look like when you have you know, robots that are taking care of security systems, and that was really impressive to see. And, you know, the liquid crystal glassware that they're using to do eye surgery, and it was absolutely remarkable. And I know our students and I know our employers in this area are ready for that, but this puts a magnitude on it that says not only do you have to be ready, we need to be able to run with this right now and start to really get into the R&D and think about the types of material science programs, chemical engineering programs, IT manufacturing programs, and robotics programs. And so it will set the stage for a lot of growth for Gateway and all the other colleges in the area.
Right. What is your best understanding of the timeline that they are at least vaguely thinking about?
Yeah, I'm telling our team to make every decision using the model of halftime. So that means that if you had a meeting that was going to last an hour, make a decision in 30 minutes. So they're on a fast track here.
Okay.
We're ramping up. In fact, last night we posted on our website an introduction to some new careers at Gateway, and we're encouraging people to take a look at it. Our classes are open for enrollment right now, and I remind all of our teams that, you know, it's a 24-month window in order to build a facility like this, which means that's a two-year degree. If you start today, you'll be ready, right? So don't wait until everything is done and then decide, I think I might want to apply. Now is the time to get ready. Upgrade your skills, build talent pipelines, work at the high school and middle schools to help encourage kids to go into these types of careers. This is really grounded on STEM education, science, technology, engineering, and math, and puts a real strong focus on our region to be able to transform our educational system to deliver that. So for me, the timing is now. We're not going to wait. And hopefully for many that are interested in these types of careers, they'll take a good hard look at Gateway.
Right. One of the things that I think we were hoping for yesterday was some announcement to be made in terms of the location of where this exactly was going to be built. And maybe that was naive, and maybe that's just our impatience, but I know a lot of people are really very, very curious about that for a whole lot of different reasons. My understanding is no exact location has yet been chosen, and I want to ask you first if that's your understanding also. And I also wonder if you could just take us inside the process of what kind of things are looked at, what kind of things need to be considered in order for the site for this gigantic plant to be ultimately chosen.
Absolutely, and you're absolutely correct. A site has not been disclosed. I don't even know that it's been selected finally. In fact, it might be multiple sites. You know, there's so much conversation going on. But I think anytime you put together an economic development proposal like this, one of the things that really overlays it is just the size again. You go back to that magnitude of the facility itself and all the supporting systems. But that means you need to have property. And so we're not talking about hundreds of acres. We're talking about thousands of acres. And so it's a big region that will be impacted by this. And that includes things like services that go out there, water, sewer services. You heard the mayor of Milwaukee yesterday talk about the wonderful Great Lake that we have and how water's becoming the economic driver, and it certainly is in this industry as well as many others. So you got to have water, sewer, electrical, power grids. You know, this technology is really a high sophisticated technology where little things like vibrations make a difference. So you've got to try and find where roads are located and where train tracks are located and airports are located and all the things that we kind of take for granted as we drive around our community. Those have an impact on how a facility can operate and transportation, logistics of employees. So it's not a couple of people going to work. It's thousands going to work every day. And how do you maintain that flow of traffic? And, you know, these are the types of operations that run 24/7. So you've got to make sure that you have backup systems to keep them all going and that there's a way that you can not only fit within the context of the scope of the project, but also fit within the community in which you reside. So, you know, you can't let one company take over the entire identity of a community. So it's downtown areas, it's outlying areas, it's rural areas, it's urban areas, and there's just a lot of dialogue. Maybe some of it's because many of them have different jurisdictions. So you've got municipality, townships, cities, and everybody, you know, has a governance model, and all those governance models need to come together. So it takes time, and right. I think that's what they're working through.
Is it possible that this matter could derail the project? And I guess that was one thing I wanted to ask you too. As has been reported, there have been a couple of instances with much, much smaller projects that ultimately did not come to fruition. Do you see any possibility here that something like not being able to secure the right location, is it conceivable that this project could be derailed? In fact, not come to pass?
Well, you know, I think it's always conceivable. You know, you never know exactly what's going to happen the next day. But this is the way I explained it to our team. When the president of the United States announced it at the White House, the governor, the speaker, everybody there, and the CEO and owner of the company is there, it's like jumping into the deep end. We're in. We're swimming a little bit to try to make sure, but we're in, and we're going to make sure that it works. And I think our communities, that everyone that I've talked to in our communities, they're really excited about this, and we'll find a way to make it work. And we want it to work because the folks that I've met from Foxconn are just terrific people with great members of our community. And like I said, they'll help us grow with them. So this isn't something that they're expecting, you know, Racine or Kenosha or Milwaukee or Wisconsin to automatically change and adapt to their models. This is a growing partnership, and I think it's, you know, growing pains in any organization are tough, but this one, the statement and has been made all the way from the President of the United States to the CEO of the company, and Governor Walker's got some major investments that he's proposing for the state of Wisconsin that the legislature will take under consideration. So a $3 billion investment by the state is not anything to take lightly, so we're going to try to make it happen.
Let me just ask you a couple other real quick things. In terms of Gateway, you just talked about how we don't want a company to come in and just kind of swamp the community and as though nothing else matters.
Correct.
I mean, a lot of things that are already in place really matter. Even for a place like Gateway, do you worry at all about how the wonderful plethora of different offerings that Gateway offers and that are valued, how tricky is it going to be to continue to offer everything else that has nothing to, at least directly, to do with this new project of Foxconn? Do you think very much about what that juggling act is going to mean?
There's a lot of balancing that needs to happen, and but I look at it like this. So Foxconn, it's a large organization, but it is like its own community. So it will need a fire department. It'll need security systems. It'll need health care. It'll need IT systems. So all of the programs that we offer have a chance to benefit from it. While we will focus on manufacturing and high-skilled careers in those areas, it's not to say that those 10,000 people aren't going to need nurses and dentists and doctors and all that sort of.
Landscaping.
And horticulture, and aviation, cooking, and transportation, logistics. They're going to need cars, all those things. So for me, it's really about how do we make sure that everyone knows they're a part of this solution. and the college will grow incrementally as a result. Now, initially, certainly we're going to have some startup programs, like I mentioned, in advanced manufacturing, and those are critical for us because while we've done some investments in there, this is a larger focus on that, and we'll balance it out because we don't want to put all of our eggs in one basket either. We want to make sure that we can support all the great companies and all the partnerships that have been here for many years, legacy companies like SC Johnson, Snap-on, and SyncCreator. Those companies have made a difference and allowed Gateway to be where we are today, so we're going to make sure we maintain our relationships with those companies as well.
Very good. I know you and Gateway also stand for environmental sustainability. Are there concerns we need to be really worried about in terms of the environmental impact that this has? And what do you know about Foxconn and its history of being attentive to environmental concerns?
Yeah, and I know, you know, if you Google it right now, you'll get a lot of different perspectives on Foxconn. And I think one of the things to remember is that whether it's Foxconn or any other company moving to our region, there are federal laws, state laws, local laws, and jurisdictions that follow all of that. And I think most companies that I've worked with anyways have really wanted to become a part of the community and not kind of separate themselves and say, I don't have to follow the rules. So our intention is to make sure that we support Foxconn in the development of that cultural transition that, of course, they will make as well. A company that's putting $10 billion into this facility, I don't think is going to cut corners. I don't think they're going to try to find a cheap way out, right? They're going to make sure that water's protected. They're going to make sure that their products are clean. It has to be. It's a clean working environment. So they know the importance of air quality. And I think this gives us a chance to demonstrate to the nation and to the world that manufacturing can be done in a really efficient and effective way and still protect our environment. So I think it's going to be a showcase facility.
And I appreciated, again, what the gentleman from Foxconn had to say in terms of what we can learn from one another. I mean, and he seems to genuinely relish that opportunity.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I'm already thinking about we're going to expand some cultural competency courses on campus and think about some of the things that we do on our international front. We have students that travel internationally. We have partnerships in China already, so it's not brand new for us. And many of our companies have great establishments already there. I mentioned Snap-on. They have 4 facilities in China. I had a chance to go visit some of those. So there are pieces of this puzzle that already exist in our community, and now we're just going to turn those over and elevate them a little bit, and we can learn from that. And that will help not only Foxconn, but it'll help Snap-on. It'll help all the companies that are already doing business overseas.
Excellent. Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College, I can't tell you how much we appreciate you slipping this into a very, very busy schedule, and we know over the next months and years there's going to be all kinds of exciting updates that we'll get from you, and we look forward to being part of this exciting story. Thank you for being part of the morning show
today. You're very welcome. It's my pleasure. Just glad to be a part of Wisconn Valley.
Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College. And the time is 8:37. You're listening to the morning show on WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. Part 2 of today's morning show is a fun interview out of the archives from earlier this year. Recently, while reading Sports Illustrated magazine, I had the chance to read a fascinating article, which in fact was an excerpt from an incredible new book called The Arm, Inside the Billion-Dollar Mystery of the Most Valuable Commodity in Sports, by sports writer, sports columnist, Jeff Passan. This is a story which needs to be told, and needs to be told much more prominently than it has been up until now. It is the story of what some characterize as an epidemic in which brutal injuries are being sustained by baseball pitchers, young and old alike, in many cases necessitating a radical kind of surgery known as a Tommy John. And in some cases, careers are resuscitated and revived. In some cases, arms are ruined and careers are finished. And what's especially scary is when one sees devastating injuries being suffered by young kids, sometimes teenagers, sometimes even younger than that, all because people are pursuing dreams of baseball greatness, but perhaps pushing their bodies beyond natural limits. Jeff Passan, a baseball lover and the father of a young boy who loves baseball, cares about this topic on a number of different levels and has
done a masterful job of exploring this important issue from all kinds of different perspectives. The book is published by HarperCollins. Again, it's called The Arm, Inside the Billion-Dollar Mystery of the Most Valuable Commodity in Sports. Jeff Passan, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thanks for having me, Greg. I appreciate it.
I'm really glad we can talk about this. There are a couple things just right from the title and subtitle of the book that I think can help kind of propel our conversation forward. One of them is that notion towards the end of the subtitle when you talk about the arm of a pitcher being the most valuable commodity in sports. And in the prologue to the book, you share some numbers that are staggering that help us understand just how much is riding on the arms of major league pitchers. Describe this scenario to our listeners.
Well, it's very simple. $1.5 billion plus a year are spent on pitchers by major league teams. This year it's closer to $1.7 billion, actually. And that's five times as much as every quarterback salary combined in the NFL and as much as the top 200 NBA players' salaries. And so it's a staggering amount of money being spent. And the thing about baseball, especially over the last 15 years or so, is how much the industry prides itself on efficiency and on capitalizing on the markets and the areas of the market that other teams haven't quite found solutions for yet. Nobody understands the arm. And so to spend $1.5 billion on something that they don't understand, it was a very confusing thing for me. And really, the impetus behind this book, I wanted to understand why these seemingly intelligent, rational people were so confounded by this complicated machine that is the arm.
So that's the mystery that you are referring to in the subtitle, the billion-dollar mystery.
Yeah, it's that we've been studying the arm for a century plus now, and even the smartest among us, even the doctors and the researchers who have dedicated their lives to this, still don't fully understand what's going on inside of the arm, even when someone's throwing a pitch.
And what? It's hard to know where to begin, but maybe we should begin with this thing called the ulnar collateral ligament, because in most cases, this is what goes wrong. It is something in the body that is essential to a baseball pitcher's livelihood, and yet it is, in your words, ill-equipped to stand up long-term to the single fastest movement that the body can generate, the throwing motion. Tell us more about the UCL and what intrinsically, in a sense, is wrong with it, or what's wrong with the way that we treat it when it comes to a game like baseball.
Well, it's just a very simple 2-inch band of tissue that ties together the upper and lower arms. And, the ulnar collateral ligament didn't used to be as big of a deal as it is now, because the evolution of pitching injuries has gone from shoulders down to elbows. It used to be rotator cuffs and torn labrums would derail careers, but baseball's gotten a lot smarter. It understands you can strengthen muscles, and the stronger muscles are, the less likely they are to become a problem long term. The issue with that is that the arm will always find the weakest point. And if your shoulder is strong, then all of the potential energy that gets built up during the delivery and propels your arm forward at 8,000 degrees per second, faster than an eye blink, is going to go straight to the ulnar collateral ligament. And the UCL can take only so much stress and strain before it breaks. And that's what we've seen more and more frequently, and especially troubling at younger and younger ages. That's why when, I use the word epidemic, I don't use that word lightly. It's not just in the major leagues or in the minor leagues, but between 2007 and 2011, the most recent data that we have publicly available, 56.8% of Tommy John surgeries were on children 15 to 19 years old.
That's one of the scariest and most disturbing things about this. Back to the pitching motion for just a moment, because I so appreciate, especially because I'm no baseball player, so I appreciate the time that you take kind of talking about the mechanics of the typical baseball pitch, which at one point you describe as beautifully chaotic and chaotically beautiful. Can you take us inside those intriguing words?
Well, I think the beautifully chaotic part is the fact that all of these disparate pieces of the delivery are combining together to make something that actually works. And you need, you know, it's not just your arm when you're throwing a pitch. It's your ankle and how, you know, the degrees of dorsiflexion in your ankle. And it's building up the energy through your legs and up your behind and up your back and into your shoulder. And the chaotically beautiful part, I think, is just the aesthetics of the whole thing, that you have all of these things combining to make for a ball coming out of an arm upwards of 100 miles per hour at times. And I, as somebody who cannot throw 100 miles per hour, I find that to be really a pretty miraculous thing that people are capable of doing.
Hmm. You make mention repeatedly of what seems to be a growing fixation in baseball at all levels, certainly in professional baseball, a fixation with velocity. And at first, I didn't quite catch what you were saying. Again, I'm not the biggest baseball aficionado, but it started to dawn on me that I think what you're talking about is that once upon a time, there was maybe a more comprehensive sense of what good pitching was, and that a lot of pitching was about placement and maybe guile. And now more and more there seems to be a focus on sheer speed. And with that increased focus on speed, that at least is one serious contributing factor to the epidemic that you're talking about.
Yeah, and it's honestly the one thing that I have trouble solving for, because velocity works, and it works really well. Guys who throw harder strike out more hitters. Guys who throw harder give up fewer home runs. In the modern game, those are the two greatest attributes a pitcher can have. Does he strike people out, and does he limit home runs? And so not only that, velocity is much easier, I think, to learn through different training modalities than command and control, which is getting the ball over the plate and putting it where you want it to be. And so when you've got this huge desire among teams for velocity, that encourages kids to try and throw harder. And when you have kids at young ages trying to throw hard, that's not a good thing necessarily. It's troublesome, frankly. And it's the thing that I think, as much as any, along with overuse, is leading to all of these injuries at young ages. And because of that, I think we're setting the wrong examples, and our priorities are off. You know, it's not about competition at a young age. It's about development. And until we get that notion through the heads of parents and coaches, I think we're going to have the same problems. And frankly, I could see them getting even worse.
We're speaking with Jeff Passan about his book called The Arm, Inside the Billion-Dollar Mystery of the Most Valuable Commodity in Sports. We're talking about the pitching arm and how there is, in a sense, an epidemic at play right now, with so many pitchers at every level of the game experiencing more and more serious arm injury, particularly injury to the UCL, which is so critical to a pitcher's well-being. I'm glad that you take a historically long view of this, even though the primary focus of your book is on kind of the current scenario and how we got here. But you share some interesting baseball history along the way, including the fact, I think you tell us at some point, is it 1883 or 1884, that's when we first started to see overhand throwing in organized baseball. And, of course, for decades, it would seem that that there wasn't a whole lot happening like we are seeing now in terms of a rash of terrible injuries. Or is that just sort of lost to us in the obscurity of history? Or is it that there is a lot going on now that makes this so much more rampant than it once was.
No, I think the injuries in the past actually were about as frequent as the injuries in the present. And it shouldn't be that way because of our advances in medicine. One would think that as much as we know now compared to back in the 1950s when they were still pulling players' teeth, thinking that the teeth were sending a poison down to the shoulder and that is what was causing shoulder soreness. I mean, even in the last 50 years, we've just had leaps and bounds advancements, but it's still not at the point now where we know enough to be able to prevent these things. It's almost like we can cure them afterward, but a preventive measure would be so much better than the surgery and having to have your arm essentially immobilized for a few months and then having to handle it with kid gloves for up to 15 months, which is generally the required and desired time for Tommy John surgery rehabilitation.
Speaking of Tommy John surgery, you tell us that it is a paradox because, in your words, it was a procedure that worked too well. Tell us the way in which it is this kind of a paradox. I mean, quite a successful procedure, and yet, in a sense, something that has perhaps aggravated the problem as much as it has alleviated it.
Yeah, I mean, there's a false sense of security when it comes to Tommy John surgery. You think, okay, I'll just get my TJ done and I'll come back better than ever, but it really isn't that easy. It's not just the rehabilitation that's difficult. It's the knowledge that the greatest predictor of a future arm injury is a past arm injury. So you are at significantly greater risk when you've had an ulnar collateral ligament tear in the past. And you know, Freddie Gonzalez, the Atlanta Braves manager, said that I look at it like a root canal now. I don't know any root canals where you get your arm cut open, you get a drill into the bones of your arm, you have a tendon taken from somewhere else on your body, and you tie the elbow together that way. I understand the sentiment he was trying to convey, which is the success rate of Tommy John surgery to return at your previous level is about 80%, but staying there and performing like you did in the past, it's not that high. And so the idea that Tommy John is some foolproof surgery is just not true. Unfortunately, I fear that baseball treats it that way. And it's the one place now where I can see the sport sort of harkening back to its old days where pitchers were considered fungible. The lack of respect for the seriousness of Tommy John surgery among some people is alarming.
And you're saying that's still in place. That's not just something from the good old days.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, that's people think Tommy John surgery is a cure-all. And, on the contrary, it's a massive problem. And I think instead of seeing it through the lens of 80% of people come back, you should see it through the lens of 100% of people are missing 12 to 15 months at a time and having uncertain futures.
Tell us about the two pitchers into whose lives you stepped and whose experiences you follow so closely in your book. And I imagine you are really, really grateful to Mr. Hudson and Mr. Coffey for allowing you into their lives at a really difficult point for both of them.
Exceedingly grateful. I mean, can't put into words grateful, because Daniel Hudson and Todd Coffey, two major league pitchers, were at the nadir of their lives. They had just lost their livelihoods and were facing a grueling one-year process to get back. And they allowed me to go into the operating room with them. They allowed me to follow their lives, to talk with their families, to really understand what all of this entails. And, I don't think this book has nearly the impact it does without their stories being told, because they bring a very human element to a very mechanical thing such as the arm. I mean, it's a limb. You know, what is there to say about a limb? Well, it's how the limb affects people in their lives. And I think that Todd and Dan's lives illustrate that as well as anything possibly could.
Right. You take Major League Baseball to task for fostering, in your words, an environment in which all 30 teams treat pitchers' health as proprietary information instead of banding together to solve the sport's greatest mystery. You feel that Major League Baseball teams need to be working in much greater cooperation with one another when it comes to this issue.
They do. Injury prevention is seen as a competitive advantage these days, whereas I think the moral view of it is that injury prevention should be something that's prioritized for everybody, and you pool your resources and let it go that way. Now, Major League Baseball is doing a study. I think five organizations from a draft class a couple of years ago, just following them, trying to do as deep of a longitudinal study as it can. And they've got epidemiologists working on injury data that they've been collecting for the last, I think, 6 or 7 years now. And so there are things that MLB is doing that are correct and are proper and are warranted. The problem is MLB is just an entity that oversees all of these teams, and I don't think it has the power to go in and say, we need you to give up whatever research you have right now and join the cause. Mm. I'd love to see them do that. I think they should do that, but I don't see that in the foreseeable future.
Tell our listeners what happened on July 27th, 2015 in Cooperstown, New York.
Ah, thank you. I needed that cue. I was going to say, did I have like a sandwich or something? I don't remember. John Smoltz was being inducted into the Hall of Fame, and he is the first pitcher to go in with a scar on his elbow from Tommy John surgery. And he stood up there on the stage and used his platform to encourage kids to not play baseball year-round, because John Smoltz, unlike so many people out there, knows that if you play year-round baseball, you are five times likelier to suffer an arm injury from pitching than kids who don't play at least 8-plus months of the year. And so using his time up there on the dais at Cooperstown and the audience that he had to discourage year-round baseball and encourage health among kids, I think was the absolute best use he could have possibly had for that time. And I personally appreciated it, because seeing players and seeing people who have the amount of respect that John Smoltz has stand up and talk about this, it just doesn't happen often enough.
A last quick question. What does this book, what does this story have to do with your young son?
My son is 8 years old, and he's starting kid pitch right now, and I am his pitching coach, and honestly, it scares me to death, because I know that no matter how conscientious I am, and I will be the most conscientious parent out there, there's still a chance that he or any of the other kids on the team could still get hurt. No matter what we do to change things, there are always going to be injuries. I just like to think we can do a better job of limiting them.
The book, again, is The Arm, Inside the Billion-Dollar Mystery of the Most Valuable Commodity in Sports, published by HarperCollins, the author, Jeff Passan. Jeff Passan, thank you for writing this important book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. Best wishes to you.
Thank you, Greg. I appreciate you having me.
And the time is 8:58 here on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. We want to tell you about some of the morning shows that are coming up in the near future. We have some exciting things in store. Monday on the morning show, we're going to be talking with Kevin Crosby. He's a faculty colleague of mine at Carthage in the physics department, and you'll hear him along with four of his students who have been hard at work on two different research projects this summer, both sponsored to some extent and inspired by NASA. And these are two research projects that could end up going up into space and making a difference in the American space program. So you'll hear about that on Monday. Also on Monday, I reconnect with Heath Fogg Davis. I spoke with him a few days ago about his book, Beyond Trans, Does Gender Matter? I reconnected with him to get his response to President Trump's tweets in which he said that transgender people would not be welcome any longer to serve in the U.S. military. Tuesday, I'll be speaking with the author of a book called The Streak, John Eisenberg. The Streak is of the most consecutive games played in Major League Baseball, a venerated record set so memorably back in the 1930s by Lou Gehrig and broken recently by Cal Ripken Jr. It's a great, great book. On Wednesday, we'll be celebrating the 90th anniversary of City Parks in Kenosha with Matt Collins, the director of Parks, and with Jim Cruiser, who is, of course,